I'm Greg Johnson.
I'm John Morgan.
And I'm Frody.
Welcome to another episode of Countercurrents Radio. Last Friday, we did not have an episode because we were on the road. John and I both went to the American Renaissance Conference, and we'll be talking primarily about that today. However, I want to give thanks, as we always do, to some donors to get the show started off. There are just a few. Anon with $12, K with $100, D with $200, and also B gave $25 a month. I should also give special thanks to a particular donor, a J, who made it possible for me to go to Amren this year and also made it possible to distribute 139 copies of my manifesto to people who were at the conference. And I also signed most of those copies as well. So a big thanks to J for that. That was a huge help for us. So I want to just begin by talking about going to Amren, and then John and I can go sort of go back and forth exchanging our impressions. But before I ever got there, I had a really interesting experience. I had a bit of anarcho-tyranny in action. I was traveling with a friend. We came from Europe, and we had to go through customs to get into the United States. I'm a U.S. citizen. My friend isn't. Anyway, we got off the plane separately because, well, there's just chaos getting off the airplane. And I got to the customs line a bit later than him. And as I was going through the customs line, somebody picked me out of the line and asked me to speak to him and show him my passport. So I did. And he said, "Are you traveling with this person?" And he pointed to my friend. And I said, "Yeah." And I thought, uh-oh. What trouble is he in? Did he try and smuggle an iguana in his luggage or something like that? Or, you know, something like that. Or a parrot, right? A macaw. Well, anyway, I was skipped ahead of the line, which was vast and long. The guy who was just wearing plain clothes and sort of untucked shirt, looked like a slob, handed my passport to the passport control guy. So this guy was somebody they took orders from. And so we went and we were told to get our luggage off the luggage carrier. Right. Anyway, what happened is I went to my friend. I said, "I don't know what's going on." My friend said they were waiting for me. They recognized me. They pulled me out of the line. I said, "Well, this is obviously something political. It's alarming that we live in a surveillance state and that these people knew that we were coming." I said, "Just answer all the questions truthfully. I'm going to answer their questions too." The guy refused to give me his name. He said, "I'm not required to give my name. I work for the government." At that point,
I work for the government. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. At that point, I could have sort of done my libertarian, "Oh, am I being detained?" officer routine and say I have nothing to say or whatever.
Greg, yeah. Did he say what agency he came from?
No, didn't say so.
He's not even required to say what agency?
No.
Claimed.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's really true.
Yeah. He had a lanyard around his neck, which was tucked into his shirt, so I couldn't read it. It's creepy. And honestly, as far as I know, these people are legally required to show you identification. Now, maybe I should have just said, "Look, I'm not going to talk to you until I have an ID." But that would have been a weird move on my part because, for one thing, I spend my life telling people about my politics. My comings and goings, especially the fact that I was going to the Amren conference, are a matter of public record. I announced that I was going to be there. So as long as he didn't ask me anything that was, I thought, off base or not in the public record, I had no problem telling him. The guy knew that I was a writer, so that immediately tipped me off further that they had a file on me. They were working from a file. So he asked me, "What do I do?" He asked me to describe my politics. I said, "I'm a white nationalist." He said, "So that means you're like worried about white demographics." And I said, "Yeah, we're worried about white demographic decline. We want to change policies in Europe and America so that we can reverse these trends." He said, "Are there any particular people you'd like to keep out of the country?" I said, "Well, I very much supported our president's Muslim ban or proposed Muslim ban. But I said, I'd like to go back to the pre-1965 laws that basically allowed European immigration focused on European immigration. He said, do you advocate it for any violence? And I said, no, I'm notorious for not advocating violence. Everything that I stand for was law in the United States at one time or another in our history. I just want to go back to better laws. He asked me what I did for a living. I said, I'm a writer, a publisher, etc.
By the way, was this officer, whatever he was he white or not?
Yeah, he was white. There were two officers, one that nabbed me and the other who nabbed my friend. Both of them were white. And so anyway, this other guy was going through my luggage as we were having this conversation, which, again, this isn't unusual. I've had my luggage opened before, right? So it wasn't out of the ordinary, and it wasn't anything that was out of legal bounds. You consent to that whenever you travel. No, there is nothing unusual in there, so I didn't care, right? My life is an open book, and fortunately more open than I would like, given the fact that we live in a surveillance society. But you just have to accept that if you're going to be doing anything in public. And then they also asked where I was going. I said, I'm going to the American Renaissance Conference in Tennessee. What am I going to do? Well, going to sign books, conduct interviews, things like that. Well, anyway, I was told to wait for my friend. They were going to interview him next. I waited for an hour outside the secured zone of the airport. And when half an hour had gone by, I started getting worried. And so I looked over at the exit from the secured area. And maybe 50 feet from the exit, there was a red line that said, do not enter. And next to the door was an information booth. It said information on it. And there was this woman standing behind the booth, or in the booth, probably sitting in the booth. And I shouted over to her. I said, may I come over and ask you for some information? She had to have the easiest job in the airport because she manned the information booth that was 50 feet inside the zone where people can't actually go and speak to her, right? And so I said, can I come over there and get some information? And she said, no, you may not. I just thought, this is pure Kafka, you know? So I said, well, would you come over here and give me some information? And so she got up and sort of reluctantly came over, and I told what happened. She said, there's nothing I can do. I can't get information from inside there. They wouldn't tell me. Anyway, I was exhausted, right? I needed to get to bed. I needed to prepare for going on to Ameren the next day. So I reluctantly left, knowing that my friend could get to where we were staying on his own, et cetera. So anyway, when I woke up in the morning, I found out that he was being deported. And they came up with some pretext. I'm sure they would have come up with virtually any pretext to deport him, since he wasn't an American citizen. He was involved in thought crime. Not any real crime, but just thought crime. And he was going to an American Renaissance conference, and so they sent him back. And they banned him from entering the United States for 5 years, which is a disturbing pattern. We've seen this with Jared Taylor.
That's just unbelievable that would happen in America. I mean, we pride ourselves on being the open-minded country, the tolerant country, and somebody gets a 5-year ban just for daring to attend an unpopular conference.
Attend an unpopular conference to interview people. An unpopular conference at which people will be exercising their freedom of speech, and he would be exercising his freedom of speech by asking them questions.
Anyone who doesn't see this as a disgrace for America is really...
And this is only like less than 2 months after Jared Taylor was banned from entering Europe. So I see
a coincidence. It's a mighty coincidence. Yeah. Anyway, this is a disturbing pattern. They think that they can stop our ideas by stopping us from visiting one another. Honestly, that's not true. If we couldn't travel internationally, we'd spend less money and put more money into other things to fuck up their vision of the future, basically. And that's what I'm dedicated my life to doing. My life is dedicated to vetoing their dream of a multicultural future. Well, really, it's reality that vetoes that dream. I'm just the bearer of bad news. And of course, that means I have to be censored, deplatformed, and harassed, even by my own government. And I did not appreciate the kind of creepy, "I'm sorry, I don't have to tell you my name or show you my badge" police state tactics that I was subjected to. The guy said, oh, I'm sympathetic, which, you know, every policeman and every journalist tells you that lie.
Right, exactly.
Discount that whenever they say that. So anyway, it was an interesting experience, and I expect that there will be many more such experiences in my future. I don't know if they're trying to intimidate me or what. They couldn't legally prevent me from entering my own homeland.
But it would be interesting to produce some sort of guidelines for people who get this treatment. Like, what are your rights? What should you do in a situation like that? Who should you call?
Yeah.
I mean, I've brought up in Finland during the Awakening Conference, I talked about the need for our own ADL, our own legal guidance, and so on. And that is because increasingly and more often, we and people with our political views, we get this treatment, but we don't know where to turn when that happens to us. And I think we have to produce some sort of guidelines. We have to, you know, get a hotline of some sort so people know who to call and what to do about it. Because in just a regular person who has no legal experience and so on is helpless in a situation like that.
Yeah, exactly. One reason why I talked to the guy was that I figured that police can legally detain you for 24 or 48 hours or whatever. And I thought, well, if I'm obstreperous, then I might not be able to go to the conference at all. They might not have anything on me, but they could simply detain me for a while, in which case it would have negated the whole trip. Also, he didn't ask me anything except stuff that was already publicly known. I couldn't very well say that, you know, I'm not going to tell you about my politics when I spend my entire life talking about my politics and why I believe the things that I believe, saying it to the entire global public, including this guy. So yeah, it would have been a douchebag move not to say something to him. So that was my rationale. That's what went through my head, at least.
I agree, but still, I'm not saying that you should have, you know, obstructed this in any way, but it does set the bar for intimidation that people get asked. If you are a white nationalist, some person of authority, some person, a police or someone else, asks you about your politics when you enter a country, that is a way of intimidating people into basically not being politically active.
Exactly.
And that's, I mean, I'm not ashamed either, because I'm also, all three of us are public figures in some sense with regard to our politics. But I don't want people in general to be questioned by police or authority when they enter a country just because they're white, because that is just a government's, a state's way of sending a signal that they will try to prevent you from participating in politics if you have these views,
basically. Right, exactly. And while I am being harassed and my friend is being deported, how many thousands of Hondurans and Guatemalans and Mexicans cross the U.S. border at the same time? While this was going on, there was a guy in the customs area wearing a uniform cutting up avocados. And I said, "Is this the salad bar?" He had found avocados in somebody's luggage and was slicing up all the avocados in this person's luggage. And I just thought, this is anarcho-tyranny in action. There is anarchy on the border and somebody's avocados are being sliced up. My luggage is being rifled through, and my friend, for thought crimes, is being deported from the country. It's just such a joke. This is not a serious country anymore. America hasn't been a serious country for a very long time, I'm afraid.
Well, I also, just as an aside, I'll say, I bet if we were really able to trace what gave them the authority to do this, it would come from all this ridiculous, you know, quote unquote, anti-terrorist legislation that's gone in over the last 20 years that, you know, of course, they claim it's all about protecting us from from terrorists, which of course I'm all in favor of, but we all know that they pass these laws because they're things that they want to use against lots of people, including people like us.
Yeah,
so exactly. we have to be wary about, you know, the reasons they give for why they do things aren't necessarily the real reasons, and these things can come back to haunt us.
Right. I would like to have a lawyer who is sympathetic to us create some sort of guidelines for travelers who are experiencing this kind of harassment. I think that's a very good thing to do. The kind of stuff that's put out by libertarian types and cop block types does apply here. I believe that any federal and state authority is required to identify himself and show a badge.
Yeah, unless the Patriot Act has overturned all legal precedent, as far as I know, they do.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
If you had really insisted, they might have done that, but they might have also gotten angry at you, like you'd said. Yeah. So,
well, I mean, if he was going to ask me anything that wasn't already a matter of public record, I would have just done my, I'm sorry, I have nothing to say kind of thing. I would have escalated to that.
But how are you to know if, I mean, how are you to distinguish just an average Joe in plain clothes from a police officer in plain clothes?
that's a good question. But the sign was that the customs people were taking orders from them.
Of course, yes.
Yeah.
It was probably Homeland Security, I think, unless there's some weird TSA thing. I don't
right.
know.
Right.
TSA Special Forces or whatever.
Yeah. In any case, it was an interesting and aggravating experience, and just reinforced in my mind the necessity of what we're doing. We're losing our freedom because the system that insists on doubling down on multiculturalism doesn't like dissent. The left is tired of losing arguments, and they're winding up the state, basically, to surveil us and harass us under a lot of, I think, phony precedents. I mean, what law or even what public interest was being served by this behavior? It was pure political harassment. It was interference in the exercise of my rights of freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and so forth. And in any case, we're going to lose our freedoms if we allow this establishment to continue pushing the policies that they're pushing, because they do not like the bearers of bad news like me, who are telling them that it's not going to work and it's creating hell on earth. We've got to replace our government, replace our ruling elite, because they're out to replace us. And in the process, they're going to trample over our liberties, over our institutions, over our very lives, and until they're stopped. So it just made me feel all the more determined. And the same thing with my friend. It just made me feel all the more determined. Once I got to Amran, however, there was a very different atmosphere. Well, actually, when we arrived there, we had to go through a police cordon again. And this time, though, they were actively working to allow us to exercise our freedom of speech. So, you know, I'm not 100% anti-cop by any means. The police in the state of Tennessee and rangers and people like that cordoned off the Amran conference. It was held at a state park at a conference center and hotel in the state park. Amran had rented out the entire hotel, basically. Everybody on site was either an Amran person or guest, or the staff or the police, which was a really impressive thing.
And they really did a great job. I mean, they were quite cordial when I had to deal with them. And I was quite grateful that they were spending all of their time out in the 90-degree heat while I was inside in the air conditioning. And I never once laid eyes on a protester the entire weekend. And that's entirely thanks to these guys. So I don't have anything negative to say about the police who were helping us this weekend.
Yeah. One of the things that happened last year is that attendance was a bit off. At least I know a few people who had thought of attending it, but didn't go because that was the first Amran after Charlottesville and people were really worried about violence. And also at 2017, these people were circulating around the premises. One of the attendees got like physical a confrontation with these people, ended up in the hospital. It was not a good thing. So
wasn't that 2 years ago?
That was 2 years ago. But the following year, people were intimidated by that and stayed away. And when I got there last year and I had to be wanded and the luggage gone through, and again, I didn't mind the luggage being gone through this time. I was relieved. I was quite relieved because I did not want to see Daryl Lamont Jenkins waddling through the lobby or, you know, anywhere else, especially anywhere near where I was eating. So it was a relief. And I actually texted a friend, "You should have been here. The security is tip top." Now, we could see protesters last year. They were sort of penned up on a hillside, looking really cringy and sweaty in the outdoors. I didn't even see any of them this time. I was told there were a few, but we were in the lobby outside where the conference room, and we were straining. I said, I should have brought my bird watching glasses. I felt that people were straining, looking into the trees, trying to see one of these people.
Try to identify the different types of protester out there.
Yeah, the different species.
Different species, yes.
And genders.
I think we should add also that to cover all these costs that, of course, are not the organizers' fault. The costs for police and so on, for protecting the event. It's all because of violent leftists or people who want to silence the people at the conference. And because of all that, there was an attempt at least at some anarcho-tyranny, because Jared Taylor and American Renaissance had to go through a trial to get the venue, because it's a public venue. And what they tried to do in order to prevent them or make it more difficult is to demand a huge deposit to cover costs by
$30,000
saboteurs. Yeah, by saboteurs, which would make it very difficult for the organizers to do this event. But in the end, Jared and the organizers won the trial, because that would be an example of the heckler's veto, of them silencing our freedom of speech, basically.
Exactly. So anyway, I got there, Jared had his opening remarks, met lots of old friends. That was basically the first evening. It was a very good arrival. John, do you have any thoughts or reflections upon when you showed up? You actually showed up a day early, is that correct?
Yeah, since I was speaking, they let me get there a day early so that I could sort of, you know, recover from traveling and prepare myself. I only had to go through the police cordon once, and that was on Saturday evening. The rest of the time, you know, I was just inside, so I really never had to deal with any of the stuff that was happening with the protesters. I was also there on Friday evening, of course, and the first thing that struck me immediately, the last time I attended American Renaissance was in 2014, and of course that was before the populist explosion and the rise and fall of the alt-right and so on and so forth. So I was amazed by the number of young people who were present at this thing. It was just a completely different atmosphere from 5 years before. I mean, not that I have anything against older people. I mean, I'm not exactly a spring chicken myself, but you know, in 2014, I only remember maybe a handful of people under 30 being there. And this time I would say maybe half the audience was 30 or certainly under 40.
Yeah, I would say, you know, a third to a half. I think it was a predominantly younger audience.
Yes, and it was just a much more youthful, vibrant, optimistic atmosphere. I mean, you really felt like, you know, we're making a difference, you know, by coming together for this thing.
Yeah, I agreed. I thought that the audience was younger than certainly the earlier ones that I've attended. I attended I think my first American Renaissance was in 2002, and I think I went in 2006 and in 2008. Then there was a long hiatus, and I didn't go until 2016. But since 2016, the proportion of under 30 people or under 35 people has been markedly higher. And I do think that's just a measure of the penetration of our ideas into the society. Also, the audience is, I think, markedly more sort of typical, more normal. Amarin has always been a Tony event. Men wear jackets and ties, etc. People have some decorum. But by the same token, there are some oddballs at these conferences. They might wear a jacket and tie, but they're passing out strange mimeographed leaflets and things like that. Or they'll go up and they'll make statements rather than ask questions in the Q&A. And those have been a perennial thing in any gathering in our milieu. There were much fewer people like that at this one than in past ones. So I think in quantity and in quality and in average youth, the audience is getting better and better. And I think that's very, very encouraging.
Absolutely. And we had a lot of very inspiring speakers as well, but I guess we'll get into that when we talk about the actual event.
The anarcho-tyranny that you guys experienced at the border, was that a theme in private conversations during the conference? And did people have any interesting things to say about it?
Well, nobody else had gone through that. We were the only ones who could talk about that. And people were duly outraged and sympathetic and so forth.
There were other foreigners at the conference. I mean, even one of the speakers, Jean-Yves Legallou, he came from France, and nobody told me that he had any trouble. And there were other, I met some Canadians and some other people there. So I don't know why they singled out this person, but
right.
It's troubling.
Yeah, it's troubling. But yeah, there was no insight into it, and there were no other incidents. But there was plenty of sympathy, which was nice. Let's talk about the groups and people who had tables. American Free Press had a table. Amarin had a table. The American Identity Movement had a table. Countercurrents had two big tables, actually. We had so many titles, we needed two tables to put them out. VDARE had a table. And there were very fine people in manning these things. So it was pleasant just to hang out and chit-chat with them. The American Identity Movement is a new movement. The left, which is basically identical with the press, keeps saying that they are a rebrand of the Identity Europa group. That is a falsehood. It's almost a slander. It's an attempt to establish a false premise in people's minds, I think, to set them up for legal harassment in the future. But Identity Europa still exists as an institution, but I think that a lot of people in Identity Europa felt that it was a target. It was a target of doxing, a target of harassment, legal harassment, and so forth. And I also think they wanted something that fit in with American nationalism. There was a great optics debate that Nathan D'Amigo of Identity Europa, to his credit, got started. He got the optics war started after one of these Ville rallies. I think it was Pikeville. And the consensus that came out of that is that we should really have an identitarian movement in America that is American. And the American Identity Movement really came out of that. And they have very sharp, very American-looking stuff. Their ideas, their content is 100% identitarian. It's 100% nationalist. It is not American civic nationalism, which is a fake ideology in America anyway. And contrary to America's founding principles and intentions. And these guys are very, very sharp. I was very impressed. These people are constantly derided as optics cucks and things like that. I am an optics cuck. I'm one of the original optics cucks. And I have to say, though, that optics cucks really do present good optics. So the AIM people were all very well-dressed. They look like a Brooks Brothers catalog. Well-dressed, well-groomed, good-looking people. Yes. And it was a nice impression because these people look like winners. And they radiate confidence. And on a subliminal level, I think people feel confident just hanging out with them. And also, they are very well spoken. They are very articulate. And the first speaker on Saturday morning was Patrick Casey of AIM. And he gave a talk on woke capital, which is a curse that we're all facing, a talk that dealt in part with the inability of the mainstream conservative movement and the libertarians to deal with corporate censorship and tyranny, because as long as it's private, right? And I thought it was a very effective talk. What did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was, that's a subject that really needs to be addressed, that people on the right are often hesitant to, because, you know, the legacy of conservatism in America is always meant to be very pro-capitalist. But I think more and more people are starting to wake up to the fact that, I mean, this deplatforming is being caused by corporate America. the free market is not going to come to our aid in this regard. I mean, the idea of the ideal corporation that, you know, only does things in terms of what's motivated by profit. I don't know if that was ever really the case, but it definitely isn't now, where, you know, I would say corporations have been more stringent than governments in terms of trying to determine and influence what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable in terms of messaging. So, yeah, I thought it was a very timely message and one that definitely needs to get out there more.
Yeah, one of the themes that I thought was widely discussed, both in the speeches, Patrick Casey's, it was also touched on by James Alsup, was that the right in America, if we want to call ourselves the right, and I think we have to in some ways because we are anti-egalitarian, but our movement, our national populist movement, let's call it national populism. We national populists need to debug the brains of our people from these free market talking points, these free market memes, these mimetic viruses that have infected them and made them powerless to deal with corporate censorship and corporate tyranny. It's a form of self-induced stupidity when these people say, these are private companies. These companies don't care about us, and we should not care about their freedoms, their freedom to suppress us, their freedom to take away our freedom.
Well, the problem is that some corporations, I mean, the social media corporations, companies like Amazon, they actually are now the arbiters of what messages get out there just by virtue of being so powerful. I mean, we're seeing corporations that wield influence over masses of people, unlike anything that we've ever seen in history before. And the fact that they're completely unregulated and that they're free to essentially, you know, determine which messages get out and which don't is an injustice. And we really need regulation in this area. You know, Trump has shown unwillingness to do anything except tweet about it, unfortunately. So I'm not expecting that this is going to change anytime soon. But, you know, we really have to recognize that these corporations are powers that have gotten out of control. I mean, they've really become megalomaniacal. And until we can do something about that, you know, we're going to keep having to deal with these deplatforming attacks and so forth. So I really hope that eventually we'll see some movement on this in the political arena. It seems like even mainstream conservatives, at least a few of them, are starting to figure out that this could eventually even be used against them. So maybe we'll finally see some sort of change in this regard.
Well, the next speaker was John Derbyshire. Now, John is a witty writer. He's an affable guy. He writes for VDare primarily now. And he is somebody that I've always had a somewhat ambivalent feelings about, because years ago, he was writing articles when he was comfortably ensconced in the mainstream conservative press about how, for instance, anti-Semitism is the conservatism of fools. He wrote about and very comfortably wrote about the power of Jews to set the parameters of debate and conservatism. He was critical of Kevin MacDonald and so forth.
Mm. Now, yeah, in writing about Kevin MacDonald had the Jew thing.
The Jew thing, yeah.
Yeah. You know, clownishness, stupid stuff, which, you know, he has no intellectual backing for.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in writing about Kevin, he actually did draw attention to Kevin. So we can't really fault him for that, because most people on the right would just ignore him altogether. Derbyshire is very comfortable with the Jewish establishment and Jewish academics, both on the left and the right, especially there are some on the right that he's very chummy with. He's married to a Chinese woman. He's still, though, comments on race and intelligence and immigration and policies that overlap in many ways with the sort of things that I'm interested in, that American Renaissance is interested in, and so forth. Although in the past, he's referred to the people who attended Renaissance, American Renaissance Conference, as latrine flies. So
when was that?
That was in some article before he became entirely economically dependent on people like Jared Taylor and Peter Brimlow. I'm one of those latrine flies, I'm afraid. And so I've always taken that a little personally, and I try not to be bitter and hold grudges, but frankly, that's kind of vile. Anyway, I think Derbyshire is a remarkably witty writer, and when he does good stuff, it's really, really good. I thought his talk was the one with the least amount of substance, though. In this particular conference, it was on this idea of the Arctic Alliance Revisited. Basically, he was arguing that Europeans and the Chinese and the Japanese, basically the North Asian high IQ peoples, should be part of a grand sort of informal alliance against the global South and the low IQ peoples of the world. And yeah, it sounds like his marriage, I suppose. But in terms of a geopolitical idea, it doesn't sound very good to me.
No, I mean, China and the U.S. are the main competitors in the world today. What is the odds that they're going to put aside their differences just to say, well, we're both high IQ peoples. Let's work together to prevent the global South from, I mean, it's not going to happen. And even if that was in some sense to our advantage to even consider such an alliance, which I think it would be just as destructive to us if it came to fruition as, you know, this idea that some people have of having a super state consisting of the US and Europe and Russia and so forth, which I think is equally ridiculous, although at least it has somewhat more logic than what Derbyshire was proposing.
But yeah, this is just standard fair civic nationalism. It is just saying that everything about our politics is just instrumental, and that our ancestry and our deep identity and our history has no intrinsic value to us and to who we are and our roots and everything. I mean, it's the opposite of white nationalism, basically. It's trying to make all the bad things about liberalism, the loss of identity, it's trying to make that work.
Well, I think also suggesting the idea that we have some sort of kinship with Asians. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I consider myself to be an ethno-pluralist, and I appreciate other cultures, especially Asian culture, which is probably the closest to our own in terms of, you know, the level of its development on the world stage. But at the same time, I recognize that they're different from us, that we have different interests and different natures. And the idea that we could just put all of that aside to come up with, well, it wasn't even entirely clear from his talk what the purpose of this alliance would be. Right. I mean, China doesn't have an immigration problem. So,
yeah, exactly.
we sympathize with your plight, and we're also against immigration. I mean, I don't know what they could do.
Right.
I mean, I guess they could stop sending their students to our universities. I'd appreciate
that.
Right.
They're a small problem in terms of our demographic decline, but in terms of geopolitics, they're our greatest rival. And frankly, why would they stop their greatest rival from making a mistake, right? Never interrupt an enemy when he's making a mistake. The Chinese are looking at us and just think we have gone completely insane, but that if we continue to double down in this multicultural insanity, we will cease being a global superpower. And that is going to make them breathe a lot more easily and also give them a lot more power on the world stage. Why in the world would they ever want to stop us from committing suicide?
Exactly.
I have to say that generally speaking, I have very little patience for nonsense like this, because this is just an example of people focusing on safe topics because they're safe. They're focusing on escapism about theorizing about completely irrelevant scenarios in fantasies, just because they're safe, and as a way of distraction from the real topics that we need to deal with. It has absolutely zero value, stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm a white nationalist. I'm an ethno-nationalist. I am not an IQist. I do not think that IQ is a single dimension along which we should be creating a society, as if, you know, societies could be created like a team for the spelling bee, where you get the smartest Chinese student and the smartest white student and the smartest black student and send them off to the spelling bee championship. That's not the way to create a functional society. So I just don't care about these IQ supremacists, these cognitive elitist types. And that's really the best that Derbyshire could be. He's an IQ supremacist. He's a cognitive elitist. He looks down on the dumber brown people in the world and thinks that the lighter skinned smart people need to keep them out of their countries. And that's all well and good, but it's not what I represent. And I would still be on the side of my people, even if I were a member of a really dumb and backward race.
Simply exactly.
They're my people.
Exactly. Yeah, I feel the same way.
Yeah. So I think IQ and other human biodiversity type topics are useful for understanding differences and why different groups won't fit together to create peaceful multicultural societies. I think that's useful as an explanation, but if you focus on that too myopically, you end up falling into this civic nationalist cognitive elitist trap, which is just another form of multiculturalism, and it might actually be a more insidious form of multiculturalism. Because, for instance, you're more likely to miscegenate with Asians than you are with Blacks, you're more likely to have your society taken over by high IQ outside groups, right, rather than low IQ groups. There's never been a society in world history that I know of that's been taken over by its local gypsy population, for instance.
Yes.
But high IQ groups are routinely able to take over other societies simply because they're smart and they're cunning and they play as a team. And that allows them to go like a hot knife through butter, especially when they get into high trust, individualistic European type societies. They can rise right to the top and dominate them. And we see that with the Chinese and the Japanese and other high IQ non-European groups, wherever they show up in European societies. It's just the wrong set of questions. It's close, but no cigar. And frankly, I think Derbyshire sort of wasted a slot that could have been occupied by somebody who was doing stuff that was like more like real identitarianism. But right. Anyway, he's an older guy, and there's an older generation of this cognitive elitist civic nationalist stuff. I think that's dying out. I don't think any of the under 30 crowd are looking to him for the future. I just don't think that is the future of our movement, really.
No, because that's not relevant to the problems they see in their day-to-day lives.
In fact, you these know, are
alliances with China is not really on the table for the people who
yeah.
who are interested in following.
There might have been a few young guys there with Asian girlfriends in their histories, but most of these are bright people who look at Asians primarily as competitors and as the main people who are likely to ethnically displace them. I don't think there are any guys there who work in roofing or yard maintenance who, you know, are threatened by Hondurans and Mexicans. These are college-educated people who are being displaced by Asians. So I just don't think there's a lot of sympathy for this kind of stuff that Derbyshire talked about. Now, I was out in the lobby networking after Derbyshire's talk and scanning the bushes, hoping to see Daryl Lamont Jenkins or Vermin Supreme or any of the other exotics that were supposed to be out there protesting us. And when the next speaker, Le Galou, started, I didn't realize that it had started. And then there was this efflux of people coming out of there during his talk. And so I never ended up going back in because there was like a crowd blocking me. And so I didn't actually see his talk, John. Can you tell us a bit about his talk and who he was?
Well, Mr. Legallou is one of the founders of Alain de Benoist's Grèce, which he was active in throughout its early years. So he basically was one of the founders of the European New Right, or the French New Right, I guess, more properly. And we've actually run English translations of a few things by him at Countercurrents over the years, if you go look in our archive. Today, he's the founder of this identitarian group in France called Iliade. I don't think it's formally part of Generation Identity, but their message is clearly very similar. They seem to be more like the intellectual arm of the identitarian movement in France. And they do a lot of good work. He basically gave a talk about the history of the Indo-European peoples, going all the way back, what it was that defines us and makes us unique among all other peoples. It was quite a sweeping talk, actually, and I could see that he was deriving a lot of it from the early works of people like Jean Haudry, who worked with Grèce, who attempted to identify the Indo-European origins of European civilization, and sort of brought it up to the present, and gave a good overview of what the threat is that we're facing. He praised Viktor Orban in Hungary as being the political leader today who is doing the most to try to stem the tide of immigration into Europe. And he discussed the rise of populism in Europe as the great hope that we can actually turn this around. I think some people may have been turned off by his accent, which was a bit strong, but I thought it was a good talk, and I'm hopeful that they'll publish the English text of it at the American Renaissance site, so I can read it more closely, because there was a lot of information packed into what he said. I tried to speak to him afterwards and kind of thank him for his work, because, you know, the New Right is something that's always been very inspirational to me. But he really didn't speak English. I think he must have been reading off a paper, because the talk itself was quite well written and he was articulate. But personally, I think he understood that I was saying thank you, but I don't think he understood anything else that I said to him. But he was friendly, and I was glad to have the opportunity. That I think he was essentially the only non-American who spoke throughout the whole weekend. So it was nice to have a little bit of a European perspective.
Well, Derbyshire is from England, but he's lived, as he pointed out, almost exactly 50% of his life in the United States. He just passed the 50% mark. So.
Right. And his style of thinking is still distinctly Anglo-American, I would say.
He's definitely
Legallou comes out of the more continental political tradition. So I was glad we had a little bit of that represented.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. After lunch, Jared Taylor spoke. What did you think of his talk?
I liked what I heard, but I have to admit I was getting ready for my own talk, which followed his, so I didn't really listen to it that closely. I'll have to watch the video when it goes up. So what were your impressions, Greg?
I thought it was one of his strongest talks. He's certainly one of the strongest, of the recent years where I've been at Amren. I just thought it was quite excellent. He made very strong arguments. He argued that we are winning, basically, was the theme. It was reason for measured, realistic optimism. So I thought that was quite good. He talked about some recent studies, academic studies, including Eatwell and Goodwin's National Populism, this new book by Eric Kaufman, White Shift, that I'm going to be reviewing in extenso at Countercurrents, and also a book by this woman named Ashley Jardine called White Identity Politics, which is going to be a title of a book of mine in the future. You can't copyright titles, fortunately, and I'm going to write the book on white identity politics, and she's just going to be a footnote. Actually, I'll have a chapter on her book in there. But anyway, he shows that there's increasing evidence, well, just from these three books, that sensible people who aren't blinded, basically, by egalitarianism and hate against white people are recognizing that if identity politics is right for non-whites, it's right for white people. And until our societies accept the legitimacy of white identity politics, there's going to be increasing conflict. And that's a good thing to have coming from academics, credited academics. And so he pointed those facts out. I thought overall it was a very strong and very persuasive talk. And I'm actually going to watch it when it comes up on the Amarin site. I'm sure it'll come up soon if it's not up already. So yeah, I thought Jarrett gave a really good, very solid piece. Now, the next talk I also thought was a very good, very solid talk, and that was yours, John. I was really pleased with it. It was fact-packed, it was informative, and it was delivered in a spirited way. Highly factual talks can be, of course, can be made very, very boring if they're not presented well, and yours wasn't boring at all. It was spirited, and in the parts where it needed to have a certain amount of emotional intensity, you hit those points quite accurately. So I thought you and Jarrett were up there with the best. And then do you want to talk a little bit about yours? I assume that we're going to see it on Amarin as a video and probably as a text. And of course, we'll run the text at Countercurrents too.
I tried to pack in a lot of information because I thought you really can't understand what's happening politically in Hungary today without, you know, knowing something about Hungarian history and the uniqueness of Hungarian identity. So I tried to talk about that a bit. And, you know, I really do think Hungary is leading the way in terms of the populist resistance to globalization in Europe today. So I thought it was I was glad to be able to talk about that topic because I think it's an important one. And they told me that the video will be going up soon and the text as well. And Jarrett said it was fine for us to rerun it at Countercurrents. So yeah, people can judge for themselves. One person told me that he'd be sending the link to his friends when it went up just because he thought it was a very good capsule introduction to what's happening in Hungary and why. So I hope that people will see it that way as a way of, you know, sort of getting a basic grasp of what's happening there and why it's relevant for us.
Great. Yeah, I thought it was quite good. Lana Lochteff gave a talk afterwards. And Lana, I love Lana. She's great. It was kind of a fugue of memes, basically, clown world memes and related memes. And I do think that it went on for about 10 minutes too long, just because when you just have a kind of witty fugue of memes going back around and around, I think it can just sort of outstay its welcome. I think she sold it as well as she could, and she made lots of really good points. I think some of the older people and the less hip people were baffled by it at a certain point too. But yeah, that I thought in terms of content and argument, it was interesting. And I do think it just went on a little too long in terms of being a presentation, just given the nature of it. Because yeah, it was kind of a comedy routine.
Right. She was even had an actual clown horn that she kept honking in certain places.
Yeah. After dinner, James Alsup gave his talk. And Alsup is 23 years old. He has a YouTube channel with 440,000 plus subscribers. He's excellent. He's very mature. He's charming. He's charismatic. He's highly intelligent, gives great analysis. At dinner time, he was talking about how nervous he, or before dinner, he was talking about how nervous he was and how he thought he'd be standing up there with his laptop.
It didn't show at all.
Yeah, looking like a geek or something like that. And I said, just rehearse it over dinner with the people you're with. I don't know if he did that or not, but anyway, he got up there and he just killed it. He was funny. He made great arguments. Yeah, everyone's going to want to watch this. Every Alsup fan's going to watch this. And I was saying to the person I was sitting with at dinner, Gregory Hood, who's one of our best writers and one of the best writers in the movement, imagine what this guy's going to be like 20 years from now. If he just keeps doing what he's doing in 20 years, he can change the whole political landscape. He's got such an outsized talent.
Yes.
And, you know, I was really just blown away by him. I've met him a number of times. I've seen him speak at various events in the Pacific Northwest. And anyway, I'm a huge fan, and he was a great choice for for the after-dinner speaker. And then the last speaker really is Sam Dixon, who gave his talk on Sunday morning. What did you think?
He covered all the themes he usually covers. I mean, he's given the parting address at every American Renaissance conference, but you know, he just showed, he talked about the fact that the kind of left we see arising in America today is the same left that's been so destructive throughout history. And he tried to show that, we have to be wary that these people, you know, they claim to stand for social justice and for everybody and so on, but sort of like Daenerys and Queen of Thrones, when they actually get into power, usually they end up just killing everybody who disagrees with them. So there was a certain black pill side to his talk, as he referenced himself, but he also tried to talk about the positive things that have been developing for us over the years recently.
I've known Sam for nearly 20 years, and we have been on the outs almost as long as we were friends, and we've patched up everything recently, which made me very happy. And I thoroughly enjoyed his talk. I thought it was vintage Sam. He is literally a baby boomer, and so he was using a slide presentation this time. So I thought that was kind of good, you know, good-natured of him to try and get down with the later generations and use PowerPoint. And he used it effectively. And so I thought it was vintage Sam, a little updated and always topical. So I just thought it was quite excellent. My overall impression of the AMREN conference 2019 was that it was first class. It was the best organized one that I've been to. All of them have been pretty well organized, but the security and everything else were great. Everything went off pretty much like clockwork. The only thing that I would recommend that Jared change, and I recommended this 15 years ago to him, is that he get rid of the microphone for the Q&A session, because it is like that lonely light bulb out there at night that all the moths are swarming around. And this time, it's the magnet for the cranks who want to make statements rather than ask questions. And
yes, that was a real problem.
Yeah. I suggested that he simply have people actually submit questions on a card and he would read them. And that way they can't make a statement. They actually have to write a question. And when I told him that like 15 years ago, he said, well, that would smack of censorship. But that was before they had their online site and before they had their comment threads where they do censor stuff. So I think Jared needs to get with the times and have the card system. I think that would eliminate the one small fly in the ointment. Otherwise, I just thought it was an outstanding time. If you're thinking of going to American Renaissance next year, do it. I think the security should be similar. The organization should be similar. The quality of the speakers should be similar. And beyond the speeches and everything, it's a great opportunity to meet people and network. And frankly, this is one of the few conferences where I saw most of the speeches, because in the past you just get caught up in networking with people and sometimes you don't get into the talks. It's a great opportunity to be in almost an ethno village, as Jared put it. We almost had our little parallel society there for a weekend, and it was really a pleasurable time just to be around a lot of people who understand.
That's really the most important part of it. I mean, the talks are, of course, important, but the most important part is just the camaraderie. And I mean, for most of us, this is primarily an online thing. So it's nice to be able to actually be in a room full of people who all think the way that we do. You can pick up their energy. You can see like how enthusiastic these people are. I mean, it's really inspiring when you can be there. And just be around everybody at one of these things. And then I think that's even more important than whatever information you might get out of
the exactly. Conference. The information will get out on the web in texts and in videos. The stuff that you can't get on the web is the actual real world community that's going on there and the opportunities to meet people or reacquaint yourself with old friends that you just don't see normally and so forth. That's the real thing that you have to go there for, and it's worth going there, quite frankly. So anyway, we've been going on for about an hour, and I think Amran is a big enough thing that we can devote a whole episode to it. So we will have other topics for next week when we have another episode of Countercurrents Radio. So join us again in 1 week.
Bye-bye, everyone.